Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here. It's at the time a pleasure and an honor to talk here. What I'm going to talk to you about is work that in general I've been doing with the people in Georgia Tech in this case, in exploring what we call the higher modes of the gravitational wave emission from black holes and understanding what we can learn from studying that emission. In particular, because this emission gets more stronger towards the merger and breakdown of binary black holes, this higher harmonic should grant us some access to phenomenology occurring during the merger phase in which you have a highly distorted horizon that is undergoing fast and violent changes. So an outline of the talk is, before of everything, I will try to describe what are higher harmonics and where to find them in the sense of which sources are appropriate to find this kind of radiation. Then I will discuss a little bit how do they help us in the sense of how they help us to detect binaries and to estimate their parameters. And I will discuss some work very briefly that will be put in the archive probably in the next week about a reanalysis of our heaviest binary, the largest we have found in advanced LIGO data. When we reanalyze it, the parameters sort of change. Then I will go to what's the main topic of the talk, which is investigating what kind of strong field effects we can get access to with higher modes. The first one will be, as Juan mentioned, black hole kicks, which is something which is already published. And the second will be something that we call multichirps. And it's that we have found that after the common horizon forms, after the coalescence of two regular black holes, we can see several chirps, so several rises of the frequency. And this goes about investigating the origin of that.
So one, just to make sure I don't miss, that paper you mentioned, that's a collaboration paper? So
it's a short authorless paper that has about 50 authors. So it's short as compared to LIGO papers.
Why only 50?
Because in principle, you put like the people who, let's say, push that analysis and then people that somehow contributed indirectly. So at the end, that list adds up to 50, 60 people, more or less. We were allowed to do this as a short author list paper. So the problem we will be dealing with is one of the typical ones we have in advanced LIGO, which is we look for binary black holes that are in spiraling each other as they emit gravitational waves. Because of this emission, the orbit shrinks and gets faster until eventually we have a common final black hole, which is highly deformed and which is settling towards a Kerr black hole emitting this quasi-normal emission. The part of this problem in which I want to focus is this one, because as I said, here is where we have really rich higher harmonics, really fancy signal structure. And for instance, one of the obvious utilities of this kind of radiation is to do tests of GR. In particular, one that people is focusing a lot in right now is testing the famous Noether theorem, for which in principle you need more than one mode. And I see that Luis does not like that very much, but I will not get into that, so I will not get into trouble. So what are higher harmonics? So I always like to do this kind of outreachy slide in which I compare the binary black hole to orchestra. So the orchestra is playing music through several instruments. And in the same way, the binary is radiating, not black holes, but gravitational waves through several modes, which are somehow the analogous to these instruments. I will get more deeply into this later, but this picture describes quite well where the higher modes are important. And for the cases in which we have, let's say, a equal mass binary, which we see from the top of the orbital plane or from the bottom, so face on or face off, the radiation is basically dominated by this dominant mode that we call the, this dominant mode is what we call in the sum the 2-2, L2 m equals two-mode or the quadrupole or just the dominant. I will refer to it as the dominant. Whereas if we if we had a binary which has a very asymmetric mass ratio, and we see it from the edge, so from the orbital plane, then we see this collection of modes, and then the waveforms get really rich and they get really fancy structures, and it's not this sort of simple waveform that we see there. So now in a bit more of detail, when are higher harmonics important? So the right plot, what is showing is the several modes. So this is the dominant, the 2-2, and then it comes, I think it's 3-2, 3-3, 3-2, and so on and so forth. During the inspiral, which is this region here, the 2-2 dominates by far, so your waveform will be a good representation of the real signal if you only use this mode, but towards the merger, the relative amplitude of the higher modes rises because you basically lose this sort of quadrupole asymmetry. So higher modes are important towards the merger. Then as for the total mass, what you see here is the Fourier transform, so the frequency domain waveforms for the dominant mode and two of the subdominant modes, the 3-3 and the 4-4. These modes have the property that its frequency, it scales with this second number, so with the m. Now, even though the 2-2 is dominating during the whole, during its whole domain, imagine I start to push the mass of this source higher and higher. That means that the frequency of this mode is going to be lower and lower. At some point, this 2-2 mode will start to disappear behind the seismic wall of our power spectral density. In this case, this is initial LIGO, but it's true for any detector. So it will start to disappear, and then the 3-3 and 4-4 will take over. So for high mass systems, you will see a strong effect of the higher harmonics. And last is the mass ratio. So for an equal mass binary, you basically have a 2-2 mode, and that's it. As you raise the mass ratio, you start to lose this kind of a symmetry between left and right in your problem. You cannot distinguish between the two masses, basically. And what you can see here is how the magnitude of the 3-3 to the 2-2 and 4-4 to the 2-2 modes are growing. This is just time in the evolution expressed as a function of frequency. This ratio grows as I rise the mass ratio. So it's maximal in this case for Q equals 8. So as a summary, if I want to find strong higher harmonics, what I want is something that is really, really massive, and it's quite asymmetric, okay? Now, the last ingredient is the orientation. As I said, when you look at the binary from the top, you only see the dominant mode, plus some other mode that has the same frequency, so it doesn't kind of change the morphology. But from the orbital plane and similar orientations, you see the whole collection. So how does this affect the waveform you see? So what you see here is the waveform seen face on with the 2-2 mode and all the modes at the time. You can see no difference between the two. But if I go to the edge, then the red waveform has the higher harmonics included. And you can see that during the inspiral, the difference is not very strong. But during the merger, you see clear differences. So these higher harmonics are going to be very informative of what's going on there on the one side. On the other, if you try to detect a signal for which you only see this piece, and you only use the standard quadrupolar template, you will do quite bad. You will miss detections.
So the EOB waveform
does it have? The red EOB has the higher harmonics. It's a model that was published in 2011. It doesn't have spins, so that's why it lacks the S. It's just a model for non-spinning waveforms that includes higher harmonics, and it's already quite useful for lots of studies. So now, in a bit of detail, I'm gonna escape the presentation mode. I just want you to get a grasp of what happens when you include the 2-2 only in your waveform, and what happens if you include all the modes, okay? So in this plot, I am fixing the inclination of the binary to be edge-on, and I'm including all the modes at the time, okay? So typically, I'm gonna go rather.
What's your mass ratio?
That's a good question, but it's high mass ratio because I see a lot of structure here. I'm gonna go to this one actually, so this one here. And you'll see that all the effect that the azimuth angle around the binary has is just changing the phase of the wave. you don't see any morphological change, okay? Now, if I fix that angle and vary the inclination, the only thing you're going to see is a change in the amplitude. And that's why typically inclination is degenerate with distance when we try to estimate those parameters. Now I'm going to include higher harmonics. And I'm going to vary the inclination of my binary for fixed angle around it. And in red, you have the waveform with all the modes. And you see how the two estimations with the modes and without the modes start to deviate at merger. So there is a kind of morphological change with inclination already. So higher harmonics are going to help you to distinguish between inclination and distance. And now the strongest effect they have, which is for this case, is when I fix the inclination and I vary the azimuth. And you see that the waveform just varies crazily. That means that if I use the higher harmonics, I can really know where I am around the binary, which is something what we don't yet have information. We never report this thing that we call coalescence phase. And not using higher harmonics is part of the reason for that. OK, let me go back to presentation. Oops. Now all of them start to play. So from the previous slide, I think it was already somehow clear that using higher harmonics are going to help you to disentangle parameters. And the best example to me is, as I mentioned, the break of the degeneracy between distance and inclination. So usually, when we report this distance versus inclination results in LIGO, you see this kind of V-shaped. And what this is telling you is that if you have a fixed amplitude of your waveform, you have basically two options. Either you are really close and edge-on, because edge-on sources are weaker, or you are really far and face-on. Because if you go farther away, you should find more sources. Our results tend to prefer face-on. That's part of the reason why this happens. And of course, you have this degeneracy. Now, if you include higher harmonics, this is in a paper that Lionel London and co-authors put in the archive in 2018, and it's now in Physical Review Letters. They did this PhenomHM model. It's an analytical waveform model that includes the higher harmonics. And then what they do is they take a reference waveform in which is face-on, so it's emitted towards the top of the binary, and they try to estimate the parameters using higher modes and not using them. So you see here that if you don't use higher modes, you get these two lobes, which is basically what you see here. So you cannot constrain the inclination very well. If you use them, then you can really figure out that the waveform, the binary was really face on or face off.
Is this assuming something about the strength at which you can measure the modes, or it must assume something?
They fix, you mean to determine the width of these distributions?
Yeah, so basically, I mean, what is the signal to noise ratio?
Yeah, they do this in zero noise, basically. So if you do your parameter estimation analysis with no noise, it's somehow equivalent to choosing a very large SNR. So here at the end, what that allows you to do is to test the systematics of your analysis. If you choose a very low signal-to-noise ratio, then you're going to be maybe dominated by the noise itself. And that will have the results of this posterior broadening.
So can I add to the first point here? Yeah. You mentioned that the posteriors will have this kind of big shape. But yet your likelihood is significantly favoring.
Yeah.
So how do you determine that?
I don't fully understand it, I will say, but it has to do with the fact that you are using two detectors and you are able somehow to access the polarization of the.
In 1509-14? Oh, okay.
I mean, we have Virgo and LIGO at the end, and it's intense enough.
They didn't have it in 1509-14.
LIGO and Virgo?
Virgo.
Sorry, LIGO and Hanford. Hanford and Livingston, H&L.
Those are kind of alike, so you don't get
to where it's. Those are like 45 degrees almost away. So one sees one sees H, one sees plus, one sees cross. They are rather almost 45 degrees away in orientation. So I think that's the source of it. That combined with the intensity, the large intensity that the signal had. But I would rather look at it for confirmation. So that was an example of refining your parameter estimation. Then if your signal does indeed have strong higher harmonics and you're omitting them, what you will get into is in a bias. So here, Philip Graff, Alessandra Borano, and company, what they did was to inject something that has higher harmonics and then try to estimate that thing without the higher harmonics. And for instance, for the distance, you see that the true value is quite away from the bulk of the posterior. Same for the mass ratio. Now, when you include the higher harmonics, you get posteriors that peak at the right value. So in terms of P, they will allow you to do two things, either correct for biases or improve your parameter estimation. Now, an example of this is the paper I was talking about in the previous summary, in which we reestimate the properties of the GW, the July 29th event for us, using higher harmonics, because the standard LIGO analysis does not include the higher harmonics, except for some few cases in which numerical relativity waveforms were used. So why do we do this in this kind of event? Well, as I said, this binary black hole was the heaviest that Advanced LIGO has observed, 85 solar masses, so it's kind of our best hope for seeing some higher harmonics or some effect. So we run that analysis, and the thing I want to highlight is that if we look at the posteriors for the mass ratio, the ones that you get without the higher harmonics do not disfavor too much equal masses. Now, if you repeat the analysis with higher harmonics, your posterior peaks at 2 and actually excludes the equal mass result at a 90% confidence. So that's, I would say, a good example of what higher harmonics can do for you. And this is not a bias. This is confirmed by the signal-to-noise ratio we recover, which actually grows, I would say, almost marginally, but it grows enough that you can see it when you use the higher harmonics. So those higher harmonics are recovering more signal than just a quadrupole mode.
So the temperature you use here were sufficient in general?
Yes, these two models were, these templates only include the aligned spins. They omit precession in this case. But we run with precessing templates as well. The ones recovering the highest SNR are always the higher harmonics ones that neglect precession. So including the higher harmonics is helping you more than including precession somehow.
Are you using the EOB?
This is the model called SEOB-NRB for HM, which is a EOB model for aligned spin binaries that includes higher harmonics.
So it works for optimal mass ratio?
It works, I don't know what's the limiting mass ratio, but this only goes to 2, 3, 4, 5. So I think the model goes up to 10, actually.
Okay.
In any case, the model is good enough for the range of parameters we are exploring. Well, the last thing I want to point out is that it's not only that you correct for the mass ratio, you also get a reduction of the distance. Consequently, you prefer more edge-on sources, not edge-on, but not so much face-on. We increase the inclination a bit. And of course, because you have because you're increasing the mass ratio and the masses are more or less staying reasonably equal, you increase the primary mass. So because of this, we looked at the possibility that the large black hole of this binary was formed in a previous binary. So it's a second generation binary. But we don't find enough support for that.
How much does it
reduce? I will have to look at the parameters, but that's a good question. I would tend to remember that it reduces from whatever the first number is 0.7 to whatever the first number is 0.3. So it's a kind of, I think those are the numbers. Yeah, it's a visible. It's not marginal, but still the errors are large. So that was generic P. Now I want to get into the actual strong field phenomena I care about with higher modes. So the first one is black hole kicks. So what's a black hole kick? The black hole kick is described by this picture, in which we have this cosmic kangaroo. When the binary is orbiting at the beginning, these higher harmonics are weak. And because of that, the emission they emit, it's basically isotropic, it's almost isotropic. So that means that the emission of momenta you have is almost isotropic. So you have that the center of mass of this binary is just wobbling around a bit, but doesn't move too much. And that's reflected by this plot. The black curve is the norm of the velocity of the center of mass of the system. And you can see that it basically does not grow. It just oscillates a bit around before the coalescence. Now, as I approach the coalescence, I lose this kind of symmetry. and the higher harmonics get triggered. Because the higher harmonics get triggered, you emit way more gravitational waves to, let's say, some directions than to the others. So the emission is anisotropic, highly anisotropic. And because of that, you get a highly anisotropic emission of momenta represented by this half star in red. And that makes that the final black hole gets a recoil velocity that we call kick. So it gets kicked out of its original position, let's say. In the case that the spins are aligned with the orbit, this kick happens within the orbital plane, and those are the cases I'm going to care about. These kicks are, so we are going to study them in the context of intermediate mass black holes, so between 60 and, well, okay, 60 is not intermediate mass black hole, but we are going to explore the range between 60 and 200 solar masses, 300 solar masses. These kicks are more relevant in the context of supermassive black holes, because these kicks might explain why it seems that some galaxies lack the actual central black hole. I mean, if it was kicked, that would be an explanation. The velocities these kicks can reach for the case of aligned spin systems do not exceed 200 kilometers per second, but when you have precessing spins, you can get to the thousands. So those are the ones that can kick things out of host galaxies. What are the key parameters for getting a strong kick? So you want two things. On the one thing, you want a highly asymmetric radiation so that you get a highly asymmetric emission of momenta. And at the same time, you want to have a very strong emission. So the net emission has to be strong to pull enough the black hole. And that's quite well represented by this plot. So if I have, in this case, equal mass R is here, you don't get any anisotropicity, so you get no kick. As you go to unequal masses, you rise the higher harmonics, and you have not reduced the power too much, so you start to get kicks. But if you go to the extreme mass ratio case, then your emission is too weak, and you don't get the kick. So as a summary, you want a compromise between the strength of your higher harmonics, so between your mass ratio, and the total emission that you have. So you want something intermediate. And well, in this case, the kick peaks at IQ equals 3. So can we measure these kicks? Can we identify them? There was this very interesting work in 2016 by Davide Gerosa and Chris Moore, in which they proposed the following. So if my binary at the end is traveling with respect to me, it's moving with respect to me, I should see some kind of Doppler effect in the emission, right? So if the binary is traveling towards the Earth, I should see a blue shift of the emission I get in the stages in which the kick builds up with respect to the emission I get in the stages in which I don't have a kick. And the opposite should happen if the final black hole is traveling away from me. I should see a red shift. Now, this is kind of incorrect from two points of view. So on the one hand, what this picture is doing is getting one of the modes of the binary and Doppler shifting it. Now, if you try to reconstruct the emitted momenta of the binary using these waveforms, you will see that you get no kick, basically because you are radiating the same intensity in all directions. There is no difference. There is no amplitude difference between these two waveforms. On the other hand, this Doppler shift is being applied to one of the modes, to the dominant mode of the binary, as I said. And we now know that if you want to get a kick, you need the higher harmonics. You need the anisotropicities that the higher harmonics introduce. So you need to take them into account. To see it in another way, if you are performing a numerical relativity simulation in which you have your extraction sphere and you have your binary in the center, you're extracting the radiation that this binary produces, right? And in this, within this sphere, your binary is experiencing this kick. So this kick should be reflected in whatever you're extracting in infinity, let's say. You should not need to apply any artificial Doppler shift. Now, on the more practical sense, this effect, although it is very exaggerated here, is very subtle. You need really high intensity, really, really high signal amplitude in order to distinguish between these two things. Because of that, for measuring kicks of the order of 500 kilometers per second, you needed a detector like LISA that can really obtain really high intensities in the sense of really high signal-to-noise ratios. Now we have seen that when you include the higher harmonics, these two waveforms seen from the direction of the kick and opposite to it do not differ only in this sort of subtle effect, they are really different. You can clearly distinguish between the gray, in case you see it, and the dash black curve. So this black curve is where you see when you are opposite to the kick direction, so you get a kind of really strong burst in some moment, and then the signal decays really fast. From the other side, in which you get the gravitational waves plus the black hole, you get a lower peak, which is here, and then the signal is not decaying so fast. I'm not getting into the reasons why this happens, but the point is that we can clearly distinguish between these two.
So the
point is that even if you have a large kick of 500 kilometers per second, the effect is so subtle.
The next line is
not. Right. Yeah. So okay, this is referring to this.
Okay.
And this is referring to this. Sorry about that. So the point to which I will get is that because of exploiting this, we find that if we find the suitable source, we can measure this kind of kicks already with advanced LIGO at a signal-to-noise ratio of 15, I think we work with. So how do we go about measuring this? So actually, what we call measuring this kick or this projected kick onto our line of sight basically amounts to find a method to find what we call the coalescence phase, or basically the angle that is describing where you are in this plane. As I said, when we report parameters for LIGO observations, we basically only report this inclination angle, which is this angle that runs from here to here, right? Here you are a John, and in the extremes, you are on the top or on the bottom. And this other angle is something we never care about because our templates cannot distinguish it, cannot identify it, and it's something we only marginalize over. And the thing is that it lacks a clear definition, because you might say, okay, if I don't have any particular phenomena that defines an origin for this angle, I could obtain a measurement of 40 degrees, but 40 degrees with respect to what? And this just summarizes what I was saying. If I only use my standard template and I try to plot the waveforms I see in the direction of the kick and opposite to it, they are actually the same. I cannot distinguish between those two things. If I include the higher harmonics, I can. Now, these two things are clearly different. The red is the one I get in the kick-on direction, and the yellow is the one I get in the kick-off direction. Now, so if I want to measure a kick, all I need to do is to define a common and consistent origin for this angle. So I can just get all my simulations or all my templates, compute the kick I get, and say, okay, phi equals zero is gonna be the direction of the final kick. And then given that I can measure actually this angle because of these morphological differences, I can report some meaningful value of this thing that we usually call coalescence phase. So let me go back. So if I have an estimation of these two angles, and I have an estimation of the intrinsic parameters, which are the ones that determine the intensity of the kick, then I can say what was the magnitude of that kick and where I am around it. So I can estimate the projection of that over me, over my line of sight. So in which cases can we distinguish this angle? So what these two plots are showing is the following. We are choosing a reference signal that corresponds to this point in here, and it's a signal that it's emitted for this binary that I described here, so something consistent with our first detection. And this is the direction of the final kick. Then we compare it with all the signals we generate for all the other orientations. And what the color measures is what we call the overlap. The overlap is related to your ability to distinguish between two given signals. If it's very high, I cannot distinguish. If it's very low, then I can distinguish them. So because the fact that the higher harmonics are quite weak all around here, the waveforms do not change too much, and then I get quite high matches all the way. So I cannot measure angles very well here. If I raise the mass ratio and the total mass, then I can, because all of these waveforms are very different morphologically. So we can go down to overlaps of 0.92. The meaning of this overlap, as I said, is that it can be related to your ability to distinguish the signals at a given signal-to-noise ratio at a given intensity. So because in our case, this is so low, so for a low kick, which is the kick that we have in this direction, as compared to a non-kick template, which would be the one we get face-on, because there is no velocity projected over us, we get this low match, we can distinguish them at very low SNR. For the Doppler shift case, you get 4 9s and whatever the fifth number you get here. So you need really high SNRs and you need LISA. So what I'm gonna describe now is just the result of what's our ability to measure these projected kicks. So we take three reference signals, so three reference sources, sorry, mass ratio 3, 2, and something like GW15914, our first detection. And we compare that the signals that these sources emit to all of this catalog for all orientations, for all possible angles. And then we can construct a posterior distribution of what's the estimated kick that we get based on our overlaps, assuming a given intensity. So we assume.
So the way you compute the posterior distribution of kick is you first compute the posterior distribution of the binary parameters, and then you use that binary parameter to infer the kick.
Right, we do two things. So what we measure is the, so this is the projected kick over my line of sight. This is the magnitude of the kick that comes from our ability to estimate masses and spins, which is one of the results we get. And the other part comes from estimating this angle, which is my angle with respect to the direction in which the corresponding simulation has the kick. And the posteriors are for this quantity, k, so norm of the kick, times the angle between my line of sight and the kick. So for, in this case, we choose the mass ratio equals 2, which is something kind of realistic, but 100 solar masses, which is not so realistic for now. And we inject signals emitted at different directions with respect to our line of sight. So the kicks that we see on our line of sight vary from the maximum positive to the maximum negative all the way. When this projected kick, the one we inject, is about 125 kilometers per second, then our posteriors can exclude zero at the 90% confidence. As I go to zero velocities, so zero projected kicks, I lose that ability, and then I start to recover it when I go to maximally negative velocities.
So under these assumptions, k equal to m equal 100, how do you then when considering those in kind of distinguish, what does it mean on the for physical parameters of the binary?
How well I'm distinguishing those? This is just reflecting the fact that when the higher harmonics are kind of strong, which is the case for this binary, I can distinguish very well the orientation. So where am I around the binary? That's one of the things I can do. And then because this is not too heavy, so that I can see part of the in spiral, I can measure this part of the of my quantity.
What I'm after is, so if I need a kick of 140 kilometers per second to have this ability,
mm-hmm.
what does it imply for the physical parameters of the binary? Do you need to have very, very high speeds or very mild speeds or fine?
Oh, in this case, it's a non-spinning binary. In this case, it's a non-spinning binary. Sorry, yeah, I didn't put the spins. Well, somehow I put them here. This is a non-spinning case. So now this last plot is a bit ugly, but is what's going to motivate the next strong field effect we're going to look at. So this is representing the fractional uncertainty we have in the measurement of this kick with respect to what velocity we inject for different kinds of binaries. So for instance, for something like GW15914, my measurement is always very uncertain. So I have uncertainties of 200%. So I cannot discard zero in any way. If I get something which is high mass and high mass ratio, like a Q equals 3 and 100 solar masses, I can measure those very well when I am edge on, so on the orbital plane. Now, I have a question. Does anyone notice anything funny in this plot? Some kind of thing that you would highlight apart from these two points looking like outliers? Any asymmetry or something? I will assume that you're too far away to see. Okay. If I put my stick, your stick, here, it kind of seems that I can measure better positive velocities than negative velocities. Could be just a matter of plotting or some numerical error, but it kind of seems. So one might wonder, what's special about these signals that I can distinguish them very well from the others? So you go and look at that. And we will look at that in the next few slides. So sorry for the abrupt change, but I will start regarding that kind of morphology in the waveforms. I'm going to start by saying that, in principle, the gravitational waves we've seen so far look simple. So when, in the sense that when we look at the time versus frequency maps that we usually report in our LIGO papers, basically you see this track. You see a frequency that continuously grows until the black hole coalesces. And then you see nothing else. And from almost the undergrad, we are taught that what this rise of the frequency is representing is just the fact that the orbital frequency is increasing and increasing, and then we see twice that frequency here. And all the observations so far are consistent with this kind of morphology, even if some of them are quite weak in these spectrograms. But you can see that nothing deviates significantly from this morphology. And this is kind of consistent with the fact that none of these waveforms, in principle, have any strong higher harmonics because of the properties of the binaries. Those are low mass ratio, and are mostly seen phase on. Now, as I said, I will use again this slide. When we are on the orbital plane of the binary, we get this fancy morphology here. So it's a bit difficult to kind of interpret what will be going on in terms of the physics of the binary or in terms of the frequency evolution, just looking at these plots. But a good way of spotting that is going to be to look at the frequency evolution itself, not just trying to infer it from here. So let's do that. I was trying to create some LIGO detector here with lines and stuff. I end up saying, OK, let's put a koala. So in this case, our koala is on the top of the binary and sees the typical chirp track. We call this a chirp for this phase on waveform. I'm using mass ratio equals 3. That's kind of important. And another important thing is that this first blue line marks the moment in which the common horizon forms. Okay, so I have a binary. They form a common horizon, and that happens at this time. Now, we put the koala on the orbital plane in a direction opposite to the kick. So this is the kick. This is my lame attempt to represent the kick. And we kind of only see this chirpy track again with some funny feature here, which I'm not going to get into. The morphology is consistent with the chirp. Now we go to the direction of the final kick. And now we see this kind of thing. We start to spot here a second rise of the frequency after the common horizon has formed. So in this case, there is no binary anymore. So I cannot associate this with any orbital frequency of any binary. So one might wonder, where is this coming from? If I vary the location of the koala a bit more, oh yeah, this is Einstein just going nuts. If I vary the location of the koala a bit more, like 50 degrees away from this kick direction, I see a clear second chirpy here. And again, one has to wonder why this is happening. Because this is something that is not something subtle. This is not some high order correction. It should be somehow possible to infer some fundamental property of what's going on in the horizon, because we're seeing some clear feature that is visible by eye in our waveforms. So the rest of the talk goes about trying to find out why this is happening. So the first thing we did was, OK, let's repeat the simulation that produced this strain. So these waveforms with all details. Yes?
A very simple question. When you say K-Pong and you've got the arrow, is
that the direction of travel of the
final black hole?
Right. So it's the black hole, not the blast of extra gravitational waves.
Right, yeah. So I just, so in this case, the final black hole travels in this direction. And the burst, let's say, of gravitational waves goes in this direction. Yeah. So we repeat the simulation that produced a gravitational wave with all details. We want to look at all the details in the simulation. And in principle, because it's something non-subtle, we were hoping to see something already in the visualization of the simulation. So what you are seeing here is not strain, but its second derivative, psi 4, the Neumann-Pernicious scalar, represented on the orbital plane of this mass ratio equals 3 binary with no spins. Okay.
This is just a real part of one of the two.
This is the magnitude.
Oh, the magnitude.
Yeah, I had the absolute values yesterday here. So you spot yesterday the 2, today you spot the. So there we go. So you're going to see the last three quarters of a cycle of the simulation. The first thing you see is just Young radiation, so don't pay too much attention to that. Now we can see that the real thing starts. So you see that this sort of quadrupole pattern is not very asymmetric yet, but as the tiny black hole starts to, so to say, fall into the big one, you're going to see how this side of this beam becomes stronger and stronger, and I have to stop the simulation at some point. There. Oh, let me escape presentation mode. Okay, maybe that's not the best idea. Yeah, I always have the same issue. No. There you go. So let me stop it when the common horizon forms, or just before it. There you go. So what you see here is that the radiation pattern now is clearly asymmetric. So you see kind of this trident on the side in which you have this cusp of the final black hole, so where the small black hole hit the big. It's a non-very technical wording. And you have this wider, weaker blob on the back, okay? And by the way, this direction is the direction of the kick-on observer. So the final black hole travels in this direction. Now that patterns start to rotate, and that kind of trident points to everyone, in particular to the kick-off observer, it's fading away. Before fading away, it points again to the kick-on observer, and then it just fades, okay? So we've seen that there is something going on in there. Now let's look at the far from the source zone. Now, I wonder if from this picture, okay, you already know it, but if I hadn't told you that this is the kick-on observer, would you be able to tell me from this picture who's gonna see two chirps, who's gonna see one? Anyone? So you see that in this part of the space, the observers are gonna receive these two wave trains that are formed by very tight wavefronts, okay? So we will discuss it later, but the arrival of these three fast beats of gravitational waves are what are producing this rise of the frequency. Whereas when I get this valley, this white wavefront here, I just see a reduction of the frequency. So this generates my first chirp, this generates the second. And for the kick-off observer, the one that saw only the large peak and nothing later, you see the first chirp, and then the second is too weak to be seen in the spectrogram that we're showing, the time frequency map. By the way, these simulations were done by Chris. So I would like to advertise the amount of work he's done in all of the remaining of the talk. Just as a matter of completeness, if Chris does the same simulation for an equal mass binary, you see that the radiation pattern is basically axisymmetric with respect to any axis that you form here. So you will not see that 3+1, that trident +1 blob structure in the final horizon. So this is just trying to describe in some detail what I was saying before. So if I throw an arrow here pointing to the retarded time at the extraction zone, what one sees is that basically when this triple structure passes in front of you, you see a rise. Then at the same time, the kickoff observer is seeing low frequency. When I go to this next frame in which the trident is pointing up, then this observer sees the rise of the frequency. This one sees the valley of the frequency, and so on, so forth. And even if you don't believe it, I will show it later. There is a third chirp here that will be clear, more clear later. Because by the way, what I'm showing here is Psi4, and what I'm showing here is a strain. So this is not the most fair comparison ever. Now, in order to picture this even more clearly, I've just got 4 frames of the simulation and then plot here 4 lines at the corresponding 4 retarded times. And you can see that the agreement between passages of this trident and the rise of the frequency is very good. But again, this is a strain. If I plot those maps for Psi4, you see it even more clear. So clearly, the passage of this trident is correlated with the occurrence of these frequency peaks. And the third chirp I was mentioning, I think you can see it here. So basically, this is producing rises of the frequency every time that sort of trident structure passes in front of the line of sight.
So can I ask a question? Suppose I take a horizontal line kind of towards the top because I want to make a point. So you would be meeting the same frequency at several different times. So if you try to link that frequency with what the source is doing, would you say, how do you explain that?
So first, I would say that this frequency is kind of rising a bit with time. So it's time dependent, I think.
Okay.
And explaining on, so you would like to explain the value of this frequency in terms of what goes on at the source. Okay, so we are not writing this in the paper, this is just a wild guess, but my wild guess is that because this frequency has to do with these 3 blobs passing in front of you, this frequency is gonna depend on how fast those 3 blobs pass in front of you. So basically the faster this thing spins, and I'm saying spin in a general way because we've seen that the fact that this rotates does not imply that the source, that the black hole has a spin, will determine this frequency. And what's going at the source level is what I'm gonna talk about later. Have I partially?
Yeah, but it would be interesting to, so it, as you said, how fast the trident is going will determine the frequency. But now if I take that horizontal line that crosses the two
plots.
No, oh, the
two chips, yeah.
So then I would say, well, the source went by at the same speed, roughly twice. And
oh, yeah.
All this thing is undergoing a merger.
Yeah. Yeah. So the separation between the chips should give you the velocity of the rotation. And that's something I was discussing with Juan on Tuesday. It might have to do with the light ring frequency, but we have not got into that yet. So the next question is, okay, we have said that the rises of the frequency correlate with the passage of that structure, and then the next question is, what's forming that structure? What's the reason behind it? So now is when we go wild and go even less formal and just try things blindly. And so this is like doing phenomenology, but the final result, the final point is that things end up working, which might be awful, but they work. So the point of the part, in order to find out what's going on here, was you first look in detail at this frame. And it seems that the presence of this trident has to do with the presence of a cusp here. That's obvious in this frame, but you cannot track it just by naked eye during the rest of the evolution, right? So you try to find some actual theoretical motivation. And there was this paper by Luciano Resola in 2010. He wanted to explain why sources go anti-kick, which means that they accelerate and then they reduce their velocity and then they stay to a constant velocity, why that happens. And one of the steps he went through is that regions with high curvature of that final horizon radiate, so have a larger momentum flux. So momentum flux is not the same as intensity of the Psi4 by any mean, But it's the first thing we tried. We said, okay, let's try to plot somehow. The Gauss, so the curvature here is given by Gaussian curvature. That's intrinsic to the source. So let's plot the Gaussian curvature of this body on its orbital plane slice. And let's plot on top the intensity of psi 4 and see if we can see a correlation between those two. So this is what we get. Here you have some different frame of the simulation. This phi equals 0 line corresponds to this horizontal line here. And then as I go up, I go to the right in the picture. And then once I hit this line, correspond to this, I do this other half of the circle coming back from this left side of the plot. Okay, so you can see that the psi 4, I mean, value is well read. So we have a zero, a sort of zero at zero, which is this line here. And the takeaway message from this plot is that the Gaussian curvature is able somehow to capture that central blob. So we can also somehow associate that trident with some peak of the Gaussian curvature that is going on there. So that's where the black hole is curved the most. But it cannot explain the local and the local minima and maxima. Okay. So then we did a quite rough.
Sorry, yes. So where exactly are you conceiving the Gaussian curvature?
Oh, it's on the surface of this horizon. It's the Gaussian curvature
on the surface of the
of the horizon, but of its equatorial plane slice.
Uh-huh. And where are you computing the psi 4? This is this like
on the horizon. It's all computed on the horizon.
Okay. So I mean, if we're computing this in the near zone, then we have to sort of worry about what's the appropriate node.
Yeah, you would have to worry, and we were worrying. Yeah.
So how are you doing that? Like.
So how psi 4 is structured is something you need to ask to Chris, because he's the one that does those things. The only thing I can tell you now is that somehow it can be read. So psi 4 can be read on the horizon. And you are just able to plot it and plot some other quantity on top.
Yeah, but I guess you like, in the far zone, it's easy to like this ongoing null tetra, and then mm-hmm. close to it, it's going to sort of depend on the appropriate choice of that. So are you like looking at the sort of final black hole and using some tetra that's appropriate for that, or
that's my assumption. Yeah.
Probably so. I thought you just compute the Planck tetra based on because there's now going radial vector from the mm-hmm. center of your brain. I think we did. You just.
That's my notion of it, but I don't know the details.
The same one that asymptotically gets to be the one that you trust. If your physics here is not giving something, but then you're going to visualize and see if it makes has any connection with the observation.
So yeah, I mean, the plain answer is I don't know the details. So once we see this plot and we see that the Gaussian curvature cannot explain those local maxima and minima of the psi 4, so this beams here, we try to go for something else. So there are two things we do. The first one is, okay, Gaussian curvature is intrinsic to the surface, so it doesn't depend on the way that surface is embedded on its ambient space. So we go for the mean curvature, which does depend on that, because if you somehow were able to slice that horizon away and place it in a different geometry, the radiation should vary if you somehow could do that. Now, the other thing we do is the black hole, what it's trying to do in some terms, is not getting rid of, it's not to get rid of curvature. I mean, at the end, do we end up with a Schwarzschild black hole or a Kerr black hole? And those have curvature. Those surfaces are curved. So what it should be trying to do is to get rid of inhomogeneities on its surface, of defects. And a way to understand those is as variations of the curvature along its horizon. So we go ahead and use the gradient, so the derivative of the mean curvature with respect to the parameter, the length parameter going along that horizon, so the arc length. So this is my lame attempt to represent it. This is our parameter S. We plot the derivative of the mean curvature with respect to S, and S is the parameter running over that intersection between the horizon and the orbital plane. And this is what we get. So first of all, this relation works very well. So it explains the minima and somehow the maxima, even if the values do not match. For this particular frame, the relation holds quite well during the whole evolution. I mean, you see more and more deviations because this is, I mean, we're probably using lots of ingredients here. This is not anything formal. This is just that wants to find some geometrical quantity that can capture what's going on here. So some geometrical feature that we can associate to the presence of this trident. So that we can say, if you see the chirp, this is what's going on, and this is going on because you're seeing these three zones of fastly changing curvature passing in front of you, which basically should be the cusp and the two sides of the cusp. So that's our best frame. For the rest of the frames, they go in, they are ordered by time, so in this way. So this is the initial moment in which the common horizon is formed. The derivative of the curvature is very high in here, even if you don't see the values then. This is the actual derivative of the curvature. This label is wrong. So it's of the order of 1 point something. And you can see that the derivative of the curvature in psi 4 match quite well. One definitely captures the peak of the other. That's true throughout the whole evolution, even though in some regions it just fails. But it is allowing us to say, if you see those rows of the frequency, what you're seeing is this highly, this region of the horizon with high gradient of the curvature passing in front of you. And that's something to me that looks like a bit mind-blowing, that you can infer or somehow correlate a given feature of your waveform with a feature on the horizon.
So I would like that to be true, and it would be very nice. And so then, intuitively, what would want that answer, but would just play the position from the other side. So then the second bottom quad that you have,
the
fact that it doesn't show it, why could you not say, oh, this shows that we cannot do that?
Well, on the peak it's working.
Yeah,
the others are not. I agree. It's not working perfectly in any plot. It's not working perfectly in any plot. And that relation goes worse as the black hole keeps orbiting. That's true. But at least for the, I would say, the first orbit of this thing, this relation is kind of working. And in any case, again, we don't want to claim that the black hole is actually radiating more where the curvature radiates faster. It's just establishing some correlation. Say, okay, if you see these chirps, this is what seems to be going on.
So just to go back to this question of how you're defining psi 4 in the years of, if I watch this movie of the magnitude for psi 4 all the way to the end, is it actually zero near the black hole once it settles down to be near stationary? Or,
yeah.
I mean, I know we zero far away.
Yeah, yeah.
Near the horizon.
I wouldn't say it settles completely. Let me just do it. You see psi 4 within the horizon. You see nothing outside of it. Let me go to the movie. Sorry. This is the final frames. Oops. Gosh. And stopped. This is the kind of thing you see.
So I mean, there is kind of
There is something going on in there. Yeah. There is definitely some remnant in there that seems to depend on distance, but I wouldn't say that implies that the black hole is radiating.
But it's just because, like, I don't know, if we took this as a curved solution, then use like, we could choose an appropriate tetrad, so it would be.
So that should be, yeah, yeah.
So here you took the gradient on the spatial side.
Mm-hmm.
So you're taking the gradient time side?
We should.
Oh.
We should, because I mean, my stupid way of looking at it is if I don't allow the black hole to evolve in time, obviously it's not going to radiate. So I should take that into account. That should be one of the next steps. We need to do two steps. One is to introduce those extra elements, and a further one is to just go through the math of.
Of course, what, you can introduce another ambiguity there, because
it's hard to, your horizon to shrink or well, shrink, expand, change shape in a significant way. How do you take a time frame?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe what you do is forget about the one horizon, you find your one slice, and then you insist on the same surface somehow to take a break. I don't know how you do that.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you for the suggestion. So the last thing, it's what's the chances of observing this multi-chip structure in future, the near future. So our approach is really stupid here. We just chop the rest of the signal and just retain this and compute the signal to noise ratio this would produce at a given distance, assuming a given mass ratio. Always no spins. In order to say we can resolve this feature, we are taking, I think, an overkilling solution, which is saying, let's require a signal-to-noise ratio of 5, which means that thing would be a 5 sigma deviation from Gaussian noise. And what you get is the following. For O2 sensitivity, you need these sources to be around 200 megaparsecs away. And it's not only that, you need them edge-on, which is less likely to see because there are less orientations. Sorry, there are more orientations, but the signal is weaker, and you only see one polarization. So you need a very specific orientation of the detector. If you go to O3, well, because we increase the sensitivity a lot in the low mass end of the spectrum, sorry, in the low frequency end of the spectrum, so we are more sensitive to ring downs, you see that this distance gets pushed towards between 700 and 800, 900 megaparsecs. But again, you need very specific configurations of the detector in order to see this thing. Because when you are edge-on, you only see one of the polarizations. You don't have edge-cross sort of thing. And our LIGO detectors are such that they are, in some way, one is sensitive to edge-plus, one is sensitive to edge-cross. So one of the requirements we do in our searches is to require a coincidence between the two detectors. So if only one is seeing this plus polarization, then it's going to be complicated to actually spot this kind of source. And the last slide just tries to justify or give a reason why we haven't yet observed any source with strong higher harmonics. So as I said, our standard analysis, in particular the searches, compare the signals to templates that do only have the dominant mode. So those are going to be bad matches for edge-on high mass ratio sources with strong higher harmonics. So what this plot is showing is the signal recovery fraction of our template banks with respect to this kind of sources average over orientations. And you can see that this recovery fraction is only one in this kind of equal mass diagonal, so 100, 100, 200, 200. And we do bad in the high mass ratios. Now we are on the process of developing a search that includes these higher harmonics. We got already a proof of concept of the search that we have run over Gaussian fake noise, not over real data. And it shows that the search is up to, well, this goes up to 2.2, but the real value is up to 4. It's up to 4 times more sensitive than our standard ones to high mass ratio, high mass sources that should produce these kind of things. And this improvement is even better for edge-on binaries. Only for if you consider only edge-on. So just some conclusions. So we haven't yet got any strong higher harmonic signal. This somehow prevents from seeing some strong field effects that might be interesting because higher harmonics reach to really fancy post-merger signal morphologies that can inform you what's going on in those stages. If we use those higher harmonic templates, then we can do 2 things. One is to improve parameter estimation, and the other is to see this kind of strong field effects. And then a couple of conclusions on those multi-chips waveforms is that, well, they seem to be correlated with some particular geometrical feature of the horizon or of the part of the horizon that's passing in front of you. So I would say that's it, and thank you for your attention.
You said that SNR 5 means 5 sigma away from Gaussian noise?
Yeah, by definition of the signal to noise ratio, if you only have Gaussian noise in your, so when you compute the SNR via computer a match filter, right? So it's data versus template. If this data is Gaussian noise, then your signal to noise is Gaussian distributed.
Then you say that LIOS shoots for SNR of 8 just because it's.
That's for detection.
It's not Gaussian.
So those are two things. That's in the first on the first hand, that's for detection statement. So we roughly need that 8 because our, as you said, our background is not Gaussian.
Right. So it's because of that.
Right.
So to get these improvements, you said the sensitivity by including higher order modes. Does most of that increase in signal come from repeated spiral or like the ring bound?
So when you don't use them, you are losing a lot of power from the merger, let's say. So you are non-sensitive to signals that for which you only basically see the merger, so high mass. Now, what these templates are doing is one reason is because you don't recover enough SNR. That's one thing. And the other one is that these signals are really short, the detector band. So they basically look like sine Gaussians when you plot the Fourier domain waveforms. And they have very simple structure if you only use this regular template. Those regular templates are very easily imitated by glitches that we have in the data. So that makes these high mass signals tough to detect. So what the new templates do is first they pick more SNR. So your detection is more significant on that side. And on the other, those templates have very fancy morphologies that should not be as well matched by the glitches. So those are the two reasons why the search should be better.
So I guess there's one more application for the high order modes. So you know, if you want to measure the sign of the gravitational wave manner, you really need high order modes.
Yeah, that's something people is working in Monash, in particular.
Any more questions?
Somebody claimed that there will be echo.
Yeah.
Is it possible to distinguish with the high order and the echo?
So from what we have looked at, the time scale of these secondary chirps is much shorter than that of the echoes that I've seen in the papers I've seen. Maybe I haven't seen all of them. So they should be clearly distinguishable. Unless for some reason your echoes are happening in a very short time scale.
And I also have a detailed question.
Yep.
In your very beginning, you mentioned the high order. There is a formula for your high order harmonic. Yeah, this one.
Oh,
where does minus two come from?
Oh, this means that those spherical harmonics, which are the YLMs, are spin minus two weighted. So that they satisfy some geometrical property with respect to rotations around a given axis. That's what the minus two is meaning. It's not the standard spherical harmonics that you use for electromagnetism, I would say.
Yeah, so if you want to decompose a scalar field on a sphere, you use speed zero harmonics. But if you want to decompose a tensor field, like a metric field on a sphere, you use speed weighted, speed minus two, which is plus two spherical harmonics.
So this is the most natural basis. But then. Mm-hmm. The other one is also lazy, so you could then write this one in terms of the standard ones, but these are natural ones for a tensor.
There is a third basis, which is the one of the spheroidal harmonics, that is the one that it's supposed to be the natural for the ring down part of the problem. So for the ring down part of the radiation, sorry.
Any more questions? If not, let's send one, okay?